welcome to this week's Yes to Life show. I'm Robin Daly, founder of Yes to Life, the UK's integrative cancer care charity. The Yes to Life show is all about integrative medicine, which in simple terms is the widest possible approach to cancer, looking at all the methods that would support someone in body, mind or spirit. Over a third of hospitals in the US now have the words treating mind, body and soul in their mission statements. People in the UK will appreciate just how far we are from this within our own NHS. The desire to stick with a paternalistic system that tells people what they can have is extremely strong the world over, but in some countries the resistance to change has been more successful than others. A recent article about the US situation declared that by promoting such therapies, i.e. lifestyle medicine, physicians are forfeiting any claim we had to being a science-based profession. Plastic stuff. So they didn't like it, but it is happening. And once it has happened, we'll look back at the dark ages before the change, much as we now look back at the doctors who stoically refused for decades to wash their hands before delivering babies, causing vast numbers of deaths by cross-infection. But we've barely started on this journey in the UK, and it's up to all of us to drive this change forward as quickly as we can. Today, I'm talking to someone who is certainly playing his part in this. I heard the inspirational Dr. Andrew Murray speak recently at Creating Wellness in Edinburgh, and immediately knew I wanted him on the show. Dr. Murray works for the Scottish Government promoting well-being through exercise, as well as being a formidable athlete and a GP. I'm speaking to him over Skype in Scotland. Good morning, Dr. Murray. It's a real pleasure to be able to talk to you today. It was great meeting you in Edinburgh recently, and I loved your talk, so it's a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you very much, Robin. And I think that the show that you have just attracts a number of guests, so it's a real pleasure to be able to contribute and also to discuss these important issues with you.
Great stuff. Is it okay if I call you Andrew?
Yeah, that's perfect.
Great. Well, as GPs go, I have to say that you look a lot like a passionate sportsman if you just casually Google you. Can you start out by telling us about your love of sport and about some of the great sporting adventures that you've got behind you?
Well, I just think taking part in any form of physical activity or sport is one of the best things that you can do for your health. I mean, if you go from being a couch potato to a regular exerciser, and that's 30 minutes five times a week or equivalent of walking or any form of exercise, you actually increase life expectancy by 7 years. Mm. You're also on average much happier and much healthier as well. You know, so regular physical activity can help prevent about 40 different chronic diseases. So I think it's important to me for many reasons, but the most important things in my life are my family. So I love going out for a walk or a play or whatever with my wee 6-month-old and my 2-year-old girl. Mm. As well as my wife, so it's something that I just love in terms of just getting outside in the green gym and spending a bit of time being active and outside, really. So there's that, there's the family type thing. It's also part of my work, so I work as a runner and a climber and really, really enjoy that as well. I mean, again, it's a real pleasure to be able to do things that you get paid for that you really, really enjoy. And who would not like to be out running in the great outdoors, trying to run up some mountains or across some of the most beautiful things that we've got in Scotland and the UK and further afield as well. So I guess it's about family for me, it's about work, but it's also about happiness. I mean, that's the sort of thing that just, you know, keeps me going. If you've had a busy day, if there's a lot been going on, then getting out for a run or taking part in sport. And it can be running, it can be climbing, it can be five-a-side football with my friends, squash, tennis, golf, all these sort of things I really, really enjoy doing. Mm. So I think, I mean, for me, the most important thing about sport and physical activity for me is actually it gets the happy hormones going. And it just helps me relax as well. And I've played sport all my life. So I grew up in Kenya. And the part of Kenya I grew up in is a beautiful part of the world. And people are just outside all the time. And the temperatures are actually quite difficult compared to the UK. So it's in the 30s most of the time, which is a good deal more difficult to exercise. But the amount of exercise on average done in that part of the world is over 4 hours. And if you think the average amount of TV watched in the UK is about 4 hours.
Right.
Then that's the difference, really, because the average amount of physical activity or sport played in the UK is 22 minutes. The average amount of TV watched in the Rift Valley of Kenya is very, very minimal. 1% of the population at that time owned a television. So
Right.
perhaps if we're looking to achieve Olympic success for the UK, what we could do is
Ban
either get more people
TV.
more active, or we can send all our TVs over there.
Right. Great. So okay. Well, look. You've said obviously you talked about your love of sport there and all these activities you love to do. But you've done some activities which, by most people's standards, are very extreme. Do you want to tell us about those?
I suppose so. So some of the things I've enjoyed doing or not enjoyed at different times, because for all these sort of things, I mean, sport gives you these huge, huge highs, and they can, reward, but they can also challenge in equal measure. So some of the things I've done have been running 4,300 kilometers from John O'Groats to the Sahara Desert, running 7 ultramarathons in the 7 different continents in each of in under a week. And an ultramarathon is anything from 50 kilometers and up. I've also been fortunate to win about 14 different races, be that ultramarathons or marathons, in different parts of the world, and they range from the polar regions to the jungles of Indonesia to Outer Mongolia, the Sahara Desert, places like that. So all things that, are absolutely phenomenal in terms of the challenge that they present, but equally you just get to meet some incredible people, and as I say, get those happy hormones going. You might pick up the odd blister, however.
Yeah, well, yeah, those are definitely pretty startling achievements. So amazing. So these two identities, as a doctor and a sportsman, they have in fact got a natural meeting place and expression in your work to promote physical activity for health. So can you tell us why you're so passionate about this subject?
Well, I mean, when I ran from John O'Groats to the Sahara Desert, I mean, I was running 34, 35 miles every day. You've got a lot of time to run, so I was running 5 or 6 hours per day, but you've also got a lot of time to think. And I was thinking, as a general practitioner, as a family man, what's important to me? I didn't have kids at the time, but I thought, it's family, it's work and all that as well. But I also thought, am I actually doing the best thing by my patients? Because I think at the time I was probably trying to do the very best for every patient every time, but I really wasn't. So I wasn't talking about the things that are perhaps most important. I was reasonably good at prescribing tablets and sending folk to appropriate specialists for operations and stuff, but perhaps I wasn't taking the time to talk about the value of regular physical activity and the value of good nutrition, eating natural foods, the ones that are not advertised on TV pretty much. About counselling folk about the benefits of, healthy use of alcohol or avoiding too much and avoiding cigarettes and stuff such as that. And not telling people what to do, but providing people with information that they can then make choices related to their lifestyle that can then help improve things. So I think, I mean, that's why it's important. As I've worked out, it's really important to my family. Will our girls live till 100? Will they be healthy and will they be happy? These things are important. And I think that as a dad, that's why it's really, really important to me. I mean, I can't think of a better present for our children than something that will give them 7 years of extra life on average, something that will make them happier, something that actually help their achievement at school as well. But that's it. I mean, if it comes down to happiness and health, that's what we want for our children. So that's why it's important as a father. But as I was mentioning at work, then I think that I kind of came to the realization that I wasn't doing the right thing by my patients. That there was a lot that I was doing okay, but that run for the Sahara, ironically, because I was doing so much exercise, just reading, and also watching videos like 23 and a half hours. And I can advise you all, I mean, there's about 10 million hits for this video called 23.5 hours
Oh, okay.
on YouTube already, and it just explains in really simple terms some of the benefits of exercise. And things like that have really helped me better understand how I can help my patients. I
Great.
think, I mean, when I ran to Sahara, I came back just thinking, what can I actually do to, I suppose, contribute more to health? And I think discussions like this, I mean, your radio show is fantastic in terms of just raising the awareness of what you can actually do in terms of to help yourself be healthy and also help others achieve these sort of things in relation to any condition and many conditions, but cancer in particular. So that's why I took on roles such as working for the Scottish Government as their first physical activity champion. Also trying to raise awareness of NHS Inform and the resources that they have to try and offer quality information on the internet about the value of physical activity, about the value of other healthy lifestyle choices, where they can go for authoritative information. Also working for various Royal Colleges and stuff such as that, I just really tried to spread the word about what's really important in health. It's not just about treatment, but it's also about prioritising, you know, creating wellness and the benefits of looking after your own health and really trying to work out what you can do that can lead to improvement for yourself and for your family.
Right. So that's fantastic. And I've heard about you for a while, but actually I hadn't heard you actually speak until I saw you a few weeks back at the Creating Wellness event in Edinburgh. You just mentioned Creating Wellness. Well, very aptly named event there. And, the very fact that you were speaking at an event about creating wellness as opposed to treating symptoms of disease in itself is a significant departure from the traditional GP role. From your talk, I picked up that you've got what I call a very refreshing attitude towards the role of synthetic medicines and of lifestyle medicine, if I could call it that. Would you like to tell us a bit more about the kind of the strengths and weaknesses of medicine as we have it and of lifestyle medicine?
Well, do you know, I mean, the NHS was set up after the war, and what a fantastic service it's been. I mean,
Agreed.
free at the point of care, offering huge amount of value to people all over Britain, and I think it's one of the biggest achievements that we've had, and one of the things that's actually massively improved health for our population. But things change. I mean, the futurologist Mark Stevenson shared that now is the true age of acceleration. Things are changing at a greater pace and scale, you know, as never before. So I think, I mean, one of the big things is that if you look at the past, you see the huge achievements that have actually happened. So life expectancy worldwide has gone from 25 200 years ago, so 25, to being more than 70 now. So increasing by almost a factor of three. And actually many, many things have been achieved in the UK that have actually significantly changed things worldwide. So I think the invention of the NHS has helped a lot of health systems further afield, as well as, you know, people in the UK. There's also been things such as the invention of penicillin, anaesthetics, medical imaging, things like that. But things do move on, and we face massive challenges within health at present. So we face, obviously, the cost and the economic burden and issues that we have from an economic perspective. There's also the fact that people are getting older, which is a great thing. But people that are getting older are requiring more in the way of healthcare, but they're also combating a range of non-communicable diseases. So nowadays in health, fortunately, we're not getting eaten by saber-toothed tigers, and infectious diseases in the UK are better treated and less cause of death. But it's now non-communicable diseases, things such as type 2 diabetes, heart attacks, strokes, cancers, that are accounting for over 60% of death and morbidity in the UK. And it's about how we tackle these. And that national health service really has been traditionally a national treatment service. So when issues occur, things have been dealt with pretty well on the whole. I mean, our measures relating to cancer are a good deal less good than our other Western European countries. But certainly, if you look at the NHS as a whole, it does really, really well across the boundaries of treatment. But in terms of creating wellness and in terms of actually preventing issues occur, that's where we've got a way to go. And I think now is the opportunity for a real step change in what we do. Creating an actual national health service rather than just a national treatment service. And creating a wellness event in Edinburgh was really, really inspiring. I mean, you shared some fantastic ideas as to how things could actually be done better. But also a range of other practitioners talking about nutrition, about the value of breathing, about the value of the great outdoors, about the value of many things that can contribute to wellness. And if we can get this information to people, and as I said earlier, it's not about telling people what to do, but providing information as to how people can actually produce wellness themselves, then I think that's where we'll get to a place that people are happier, people are healthier, and people are probably even regularly living to 100 should they wish to do so.
So your role, the GP's role, it's a very particular one due to the position they hold right at the front line. They're kind of they're the people we ring up. They're our first port of call. One of my recent guests on the Yesterlife show, Dr. Rupi Aujla, he's another GP. Now he's absolutely determined to get nutrition into GP's training. So he's putting forward a completely new picture of the role that GPs could play in promoting wellness, particularly. And so he wants to change attitudes towards health, much in the direction that you've been talking about. What's your particular vision for the development of the GP role over the next few years?
Great question again. And I think, I mean, it's fair to say that general practitioners do an absolutely terrific job, but I do think there is a further opportunity just to try and work out how, in the face of the changing demands that people are placing upon the NHS and primary care in particular, how can we do things better? How can we do things smarter? So one thing is, I think, having good quality information online. I think NHS Inform is certainly a start in terms of offering, you know, a real frontline service. Where do you access pharmacy? Where do you access general practice? Where can you get some tailored information for your own health, and also how to, you know, create wellness for yourself? But as general practitioners, I think it's wider than that, in fact, because I think that all healthcare practitioners, be they nurses, physios, general practitioners, hospital specialists, pharmacists, people right across the board, each of us has got a key role in terms of creating wellness and promoting things that can actually have people regularly physically active, eating well, avoiding the unhealthy use of alcohol and smoking. And I think that's something that the traditional medical training hasn't really promoted. When I went to university, graduating in 2003, I learnt a lot about rare tropical diseases such as tropical sprue and stuff. In fact, we had an entire lecture on that. But, you know, the value of physical activity and the value of healthy eating weren't really in that. So I'm pleased to say that tomorrow's doctors now in Scotland are actually being better educated on it. And the value of physical activity is now a part of all five medical curriculums, and in fact all allied healthcare professional curriculums in Scotland. And allied healthcare professions are hugely important, including physios, occupational therapists, radiologists, etc., etc. So I think, you know, that's definitely a few steps forward, but I think we need to do the same in relation to nutrition, because you are what you eat and it can make a huge, huge difference. So I think whilst there are some good things in the medical curriculum, while there are some good things in GP training as well, we can optimise it. We can make it more focused on what actually matters to people, what matters to individuals, and how can we do things that will make the biggest difference to our patients. Because we know that worldwide, if you look at the Global Burden of Disease study, that's the biggest study that looks worldwide across all the things that cause mischief and death and morbidity to people worldwide. And essentially, high blood pressure is the number one.
Right.
The physical inactivity, smoking, alcohol, unhealthy nutrition, these guys are 2, 3, 4, and 5 consistently, along with air pollution in some parts of the world. So these are the most important things. You know, health in the UK is not struggling so much due to a lack of medication or a lack of rescue helicopters and a lack of
right.
Good operations. I mean, these things could be done more of as well. But the big thing that will drive health forward more is if we get people, you know, eating well, being physically active, avoiding fags and stuff like that as well. And these are the things that are going to make the biggest difference. So I think leaders such as our colleagues like Rupi Ujala and others that are really promoting this and taking this forward are an inspiration to myself and are definitely going to make things better. Mm. And they're going to help promote these sort of things for general practitioners, because GPs are doing a fantastic job. And if we share these informations with them, I'm sure that they'll further their efforts in relation to promoting good nutrition.
Great, yeah. Now, one thing I picked up on you said there, this relates to the fact that there's two types of information. There's general information, and then there's what you call tailored information. And they both have a role and an importance. I mean, we're aware of this as a charity. We aim to supply both. General information can be very useful, particularly at a kind of research level, when you're finding out what's what. But when it comes to actually making decisions about what's actually right for you, tailored information can be so important, can't it? And so if the NHS is going to make a difference here, that kind of level of information is going to be needed, much as is being demonstrated when Dr. Rangan Chatterjee, I'm going to mention him later, but he's been on the TV. They're going into people's homes, actually finding out about their situation in some detail before he can then say, okay, well, that's not going to work for you, but this is. That's actually what we need, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, it's what matters to people, because it's people rather than issues and diseases that we're treating. And I think that's a really refreshing and important attitude to have, is just that how can we identify exactly what matters the most to that person, and then how can we take things forward for them? And our job as health professionals is about treating disease, but it's also about creating wellness and also working out how we can support that person to be at their best more of the time.
Yes.
And that can have implications for kind of physical health, it can be mental health that we're supporting, it can be social issues, it can be emotional issues, it can be spiritual issues. And I think these things are all equally important. So, I mean, there's a concentration on physical health issues, I would say, at present in the NHS in Britain, but I think that concentrating more on mental health issues and social issues, again, on emotional and spiritual things, I think will lead to improvement in terms of the standard of care that we offer for folks. I think, I mean, yes, to life is good in terms of just offering a really holistic approach. And you're right in terms of it's not that everyone wants chocolate ice cream, it's that we're trying to offer something that that individual wants at that particular point in time. So it's, I suppose, offering a tailored approach, and that's what we're looking to do as individuals, you know. But it's also what we're looking to create as a system. And you see that a little bit more in terms of the internet and what's being done in social media and things like that as well. It's about, I suppose, just trying to work out exactly what might influence that person and support them to make healthy lifestyle choices. But then also, I mean, that's just great that Dr. Rangan Chatterjee is doing that, as he's actually exploring things where that person lives in their house, working at what's important to them, and perhaps also just speaking to their relatives and friends and working out how we can best support folk to get to the place that they want to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I'd really value your thoughts on this. What do you think the biggest things that we should be looking at as a National Health Service are at present?
I think you're onto a lot of them there. It's been surprising how exercise has come in from sort of kind of left field and has gained ground very quickly in a way that nutrition has never done, and it's still a very sticky subject. Exercise has no huge corporates who are trying to manage what's happening in order to protect their bottom lines. So it seems to have been, once the evidence has begun to build, it seems to have very quickly taken hold, and it's a delight to see how much it's been promoted in cancer and elsewhere as being a great thing for everybody. The same can't be said about nutrition, but it's at least as important, if not more so, I'd say. And so, you know, personally, that's the biggest single area, I think. I mean, I would agree with you about the psychological and emotional side of things as well, and I'm glad to see that's getting highlighted a bit more, thanks to a few royals, and, you know, it's coming out as being something we need to talk about. But I have to say, it's nutrition. We're so backward in this country about attitudes to nutrition within healthcare service. It's shocking to me.
I think we do need to look wider, and I think you're dead right, is that nutrition is particularly important and also a particularly thorny issue. Because I think, I mean, if you even look at TV advertising at present, I mean, I think that only 1% of advertising is for fresh organic produce, you know, healthy fresh fruit and vegetables and things such as that.
I'm surprised it's that much.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I saw the stats and I was actually almost pleasantly surprised.
Mm.
But these industries are really, really quite protective of their own product, and they'll say, oh, you know, it's only part of a healthy, balanced diet. But the reality is that they're a business, so they're trying to sell their own stuff.
Yeah.
And most of the stuff that's being advertised is not inherently that good for you. I mean, I grew up in Kenya, and there was just, you know, fresh, organic produce all the time. And as I was saying, there wasn't such a thing as TV or internet, social media and stuff.
Mm.
So people just got on with what was culturally normal and ate well. And although health outcomes are better in the UK than they are in Kenya, there are obviously many different reasons for that. But I would say that nutrition and physical activity were things that they do really, really well. And I do think there's a great role, you know, as the world gets smaller, to actually learn from other countries. There's absolutely no doubt at all that eating well is a massive show in town, and the global burden of disease shows that that's important in the UK, it shows it's important in Europe, it shows it's important worldwide, and it also shows that we need to be concentrating more of it. I mean, if unhealthy nutrition is the third or fourth biggest cause of death worldwide,
right,
and of morbidity worldwide, and at least as important in that in the UK, then why is that not front and centre of what we're doing in medical schools? Why is it not front and centre of what we're learning about in nursing and allied health professional type schools? And indeed, why isn't that the sort of thing that we're chatting to about patients at each and every consultation? And whenever people come into hospital, I mean, I've enjoyed sport all my life. There have been occasions that I've been a patient that I've made bones less straight than they should be. And whenever I go into hospital, I get asked about smoking and I get asked about alcohol, but I've never really been asked about my nutrition. I've never really been asked, which, you know, at times has been shocking when I was a student. And I've never really been asked about my rates of physical activity as well. And I think these are the things. I mean, people have recognised alcohol and smoking as important, but nutrition and physical activity have always been the Cinderella for a period of time. And it's good to see that physical activity is being increasingly recognised. But I would completely concur that we need to, you know, make sure that people understand the value of good nutrition. How it can significantly improve their wellness and health and well-being as well. And if we do that and commit significant funds and significant human resource towards it, it will improve things. There's no doubt about that.
Right. Okay, so in terms of embracing lifestyle medicine, there's two possible avenues a GP could take. They could broaden their own training, just like we discussed. But another potentially speedier route would be to start to embrace all the practitioners who are out there who are already skilled in these things. Now, this may be happening with exercise specialists to some extent now. I hope it is. It's certainly not happening with nutritionists, I don't think. They're out there. There's a huge number of them, and they're incredibly skilled, a lot of them as well, in specialist areas. And they're ripe for referrals, really, if there was to be an embrace of the importance of nutrition in healthcare. Those are two rather different routes. Which would you favour of those two, or do you think they both have value?
We absolutely need to do both. So we need to be competent ourselves in terms of embracing the importance of emphasising good nutrition and regular physical activity and alcohol and, you know, avoiding smoking to our patients. So that's something that it doesn't take much. It's about asking the question, you know, how many minutes per day are you physically active for and on how many days per week? And then offering appropriate brief advice as to, you know, even if you walk 30 minutes five times a week, you know, you'll probably get 7 years of extra life. It will probably help the type 2 diabetes or the depression you've come to see me about. So we need to know about this, because otherwise we're not really able to do all that we can for our patients. But there's also, you know, a real importance in terms of recognising and knowing how to signpost appropriate. So signposting to trusted internet providers such as NHS Inform, but also to say nutrition specialists, exercise specialists, those that know the most about specific issues, and taking that forward with them. Because, you know, we're quite likely to signpost towards cardiologists or physiotherapists or other people that have got, you know, a massive role in terms of offering specific expertise in things that they're very good at. You know, as generalists, we know a little about a lot. Or a fair bit about a lot as well, but we can't know everything. So I think certainly being able to signpost towards, you know, exercise specialists, nutritionists, and also signposting towards free resources, for example, like NHS Inform or other websites, you know, if people get value out of Yes to Life and other things like that, that can really just help people better understand their own illness, their own health and stuff like that, then I think that offers value. So you're dead right. I mean, we can do more. Good is the enemy of better. It's a good system already, but we need to do more. The next steps, I think, as GPs are better understanding what we can do and being equipped with the sort of training that enables us to do that, but then also just knowing how we accurately signpost towards those that are best placed to take things forward for folk and perhaps have a bit more time.
So it's quite likely that one will spring from the other, actually, that the more that GPs have an understanding of the role of nutrition, the more they'll want to refer them on to specialists in specialist situations.
Absolutely, and I see that myself. You know, as a general practitioner, I got additional training in sport and exercise medicine, and I've set up a clinic. So I work at the University of Edinburgh, and we look at any sort of illness or injuries relating to physical activity and sport. But we also try and advise folk as to how people could be more active as well. So I guess, I mean, that training that I initially received, sitting in my camper van reading about it when I was running to Morocco, has actually stimulated me to actually set up that sort of service and offer a bit more value that way as well. So I think education is power. The more information we've got, the better equipped we are as GPs or healthcare professionals to provide quality advice to our patients. And I think it's just about optimising that training. Right. Making sure that if, for example, unhealthy nutrition is more common than tropical sprue in Scotland or the UK, then perhaps the training reflects that.
Right.
But then also, I mean, if there are some excellent educational resources out there, or if there's a network of people that can help support people to eat better and to be regularly physically active, then that's terrific, and we can signpost and really, work as a team to improve health and well-being.
Great. All right, so we mentioned Dr. Rangan Chatterjee earlier. He's been gracing the nation's screens with his Doctor in the House series. There are more shows coming up, I understand. So he's very aware of the limitations of the medication concept and of the power of lifestyle to resolve chronic disease. And he's gained much of this understanding from his own specialist training. He's been to America and trained in functional medicine. Now, functional medicine's making great strides in America, and they've opened their first major clinic in a hospital, which is entirely based on functional medicine. And certainly, functional medicine view is being much more widely embraced over there than, well, it hasn't even started here, really. So, do you think the NHS is capable of embracing this kind of completely different view of health promotion?
I think that the NHS is increasingly looking to do more health promotion. And I think, speaking to the executives and speaking to the ministers, certainly north of the border and also south of the border, people recognise that there is a clear, compelling argument to promote health and to create wellness as well as to treat disease. So the argument is compelling and the aim is clear, is to promote health and to get more people more active and eating better and stuff like that. It's by what method? How do we actually get this done? And that's the tricky thing. People know it's important. People know what we're looking to do and what good would look like, but it's how we actually get it done. And I think there are strides happening, but I think certainly what we must do is continue to carry on with the good practices that have been established. And there are obviously, very good reasons for taking many medications and also referring for various other types of treatment. So certainly, it's important that we continue to embrace the good work that is going on, but I do think we have a substantial opportunity to really promote health. And that can be within health and social care, but it can also be about making it normal, another sort of context as well. So making healthy lifestyle choices available and the norm in our schools, in old folks' homes, in all sorts of environments, I think is hugely important. So it's about, I suppose, clearing the path and making it a bit easier for folk to live a healthy lifestyle as well as actually making it a part of what we're doing in health and social care. Because health and social care, obviously, we are important, but I do think that in terms of communications, it's about getting those sort of right messages out at pace and scale. It's also about education and making this a reality in our schools. It's about, having the infrastructure that makes it easier for folk to eat well and to be physically active in terms of, walking and cycle paths and so on and so on. So there's a range of different things that make it important. So I certainly wouldn't underestimate the importance of health and social care in terms of health promotion, but I do think that other sectors have a huge role in this as well. And I do think communication is important, which is why I think it's great that we're having this conversation, because getting that sort of information out, sharing it, that knowledge is stuff that some people will embrace. And I think that we will get there, but it does need a significant cultural change in what we're doing in the NHS at present.
Well, there's a possibility that the GPs could be leading the vanguard here. I understand that there's a kind of Rangan Chatterjee effect, which is that a large number of GPs have turned up at the functional medicine training in the UK following his appearance on TV. So it presumably is inspiring other people who realise that there are shortcomings in what they have on offer to patients and want to do something different. And the fact that the GP is this first port of call and has authority, when a GP says to somebody, "Look, you've really got to stop smoking," whatever it is, that's one of the people they might listen to. So, they're in a key position to actually look into people's habits and help them change them in a way that many other people aren't. And so, there's a fair chance that they could actually provide quite a leading role in this, I think.
Yeah, I think there's every chance. But I think we're all leaders in this. So whether you're a general practitioner, whether you're a nursery nurse, whether you're involved in school, whether you work at leisure centres, whether you're involved in catering and stuff, we've all got a role to help people to make healthier lifestyle choices. So I think it's fantastic that, there are initiatives that are getting more people and GPs in particular kind of involved in this and kind of shifting the culture towards health promotion as well as treatment. But I mean, I do think to people listening to this, please do not underestimate your own ability to actually impact health for family, for friends, for work colleagues and stuff. Sometimes it's just as simple as just saying, oh, you know, rather than having a meeting, sitting down and actually just going out. Today's a beautiful day, getting out for a walking meeting. Or perhaps if you are going out for lunch, then going to a place that's likely to offer more nutritious food, or just doing things like that, you know, that essentially are influencing people towards health promotion. So I think, and certainly, you know, as I say, my girls go to nursery and stuff, and there's some fantastic things that are going on in terms of fellow parents instituting and suggesting things that get people outside and get the kids enjoying not only being in soft play inside, but actually getting out for exercise, making the menu a bit healthier and stuff. So I think as parents, as friends, as colleagues, as people in society, we've got a huge role as individuals, and perhaps we have to as well. I mean, the UK has been the sick man of Europe for quite some time, so perhaps it's for us to actually, you know, take the bulls by our horns ourselves, as well as our health professionals as well.
Great, I like a great message that we're all leaders in this. Okay, so this show is all about cancer. Well, it's itself largely a lifestyle disease, and the UK is languishing right at the bottom of the European league tables for its success in treating it. Despite this, there's a shocking lack of interest in lifestyle approaches, and this persists in the NHS. But meanwhile, the public, their faith in lifestyle medicine is growing very rapidly. So how significant do you think lifestyle medicine could be in improving the cancer outcomes in the UK?
Very significant. And I think, you know, important shows like this can actually just highlight the role of lifestyle medicine in combating cancer, you know, both in primary prevention, preventing cancer before it occurs, but then also if cancer is being suffered, then essentially just about working out the role of lifestyle medicine and helping improve outcomes at that point. And I think if we do that, then the UK is likely to shift away from the bottom. It's lower than a snake's belly in terms of the European league tables at present.
Right.
But I think hopefully if we embrace this, then we can at least get up to mid-table. And I'm not saying that we'll be the Barcelona or Real Madrid anytime soon, but I certainly think if we can embrace this and make that step change, then that improvement will come. And in terms of primary prevention, I mean, I'm more expert in physical activity than any of the other aspects of lifestyle medicine, but we do know that regular physical activity can substantially improve outcomes in terms of preventing breast cancer and colon cancer in 20 to 40% of cases. It's also got a really significant role in terms of improving health and well-being of those that do suffer with cancer, probably improving longevity in the majority of cases, but certainly improving health and well-being and people's social and emotional health in that context. So it can be hugely important. And I think, again, I mean, people are starting to recognise the value of physical activity in it, but I think recognising the value of nutrition in particular is really, really important. And also social connection. How can we build social connection for those that are suffering from cancer? Because we know that by itself can be massively impactful and helpful.
Mm. Yeah, that's great. I must say, of course, I certainly feel that lifestyle medicine could have a massive impact on these statistics. If you put that together with the problems around diagnosis, where people are misdiagnosed or very late diagnosed, which is well known as well, put those two together, I think they could have a major impact on our position in the league tables. I think those are just two areas we fall down on massively.
I completely concur. And I mean, you're obviously a leading expert on cancer and wellness and stuff. So I think that the opportunity is huge. I mean, it's difficult to actually just recognise how big this opportunity is because, do you know, in terms of communications, I mean, 90% of what we see about the NHS is negative in newspapers, but actually 90%
is that right?
Of what goes on is really, really positive.
Mm.
But I do think what we can do is we can actually recognise the huge opportunity here. Rather than us, you know, sitting and moaning about it, it's a bit like what yourself and many others are doing. It's just how do we actually look for solutions? How can we make things better? How can we drive things forward? How can we improve things for ourselves, for our family, for our loved ones, for our friends, for our colleagues, for the people that we look after and stuff like that. And that's how we're going to do this, is we're actually going to look for solutions and make things better.
Great. Okay, so as I mentioned before, the introduction of lifestyle medicine and the concepts around wellness, they're a massive cultural shift away from seeing treatment for chronic disease almost exclusively in terms of drugs, basically, in expensive synthetic chemicals, and they're largely aimed at containing symptoms. That's the way things are, and there are large forces at work to keep this as it is, because it's working for some people, if not for the people who have the health problems. So do you think the change away from this, which is a huge cultural shift, do you think it's happening anyway? Do you think it's on its way? And if so, what are the things that are going to drive this? Because yeah, there's very strong forces at work to keep things as they are, even though it doesn't work.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the power of big pharma is well documented. But as I say, I mean, there are some massively beneficial effects of these expensive synthetic chemicals. They certainly do have the
Well,
utilities
of
and
course
can
they do.
help
Of course they
contain
do.
symptoms and provide a lot of benefit. So let's not forget the value they offer, but let's also just recognize that what we need to do is focus on the actual benefits that we can get from a healthy and active lifestyle as well. So this stuff may or may not happen anyway. But certainly, I mean, I think if we can put our noses to the grindstone, if we can do what we can do ourselves, as individuals and organizations, then that's what's going to change the culture.
Right.
So I think that because the evidence is so compelling that this is stuff that is going to happen anyway, but it'll happen a good deal faster if we help support it and drive and lead this forward. I mean, people now accept that the world is round. People now accept that round wheels are a lot better and stuff like that. And equally so, I mean, health promotion, a healthy and active lifestyle are things that are without question the right thing to do. But it's just a question of how we can actually help share this information, have the public better understand the value of these sort of things, and then just drive things forward together that I think will help ensure that this massive cultural shift is achieved. Because it is going to happen, but I think we can certainly speed that process.
So it's what you call a grassroots movement.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think that's it. I mean, it's something that is not easy to achieve, but nothing great is easy. I mean,
Right.
I remember just thinking when I was trying to run that, 4,300 kilometers from John O'Groats to the Sahara Desert, I was just thinking, this is so difficult. I want to stop. There are significant challenges. There are barriers in our way. And getting people to embrace healthy nutrition and physical activity is difficult.
Right.
Taking those first few steps off the couch, eating more healthily, influencing others to do so. This stuff is not easy, but it is totally worth it, and I think it is something that we can achieve. And I mean, I for one, I'm extremely keen for all sorts of reasons to help promote it as business as usual in the future.
Right. All right, so I don't think I'm alone in seeing the NHS as a superb deliverer of acute medicine. You were saying that most of the press is negative, but actually, there's nobody who doesn't appreciate how well they get dealt with when they get picked up off the road after being hit and they get put back together, or if they have a heart problem, they need a bypass operation. The statistics are fantastic for the success rates, and the NHS really can deliver on this stuff. But it's around chronic disease, notably cancer, because that's what I'm looking at all the time. But it applies across the board on chronic disease. There isn't the same kind of level of achievement and success there. And it's my personal belief that lifestyle medicine is what's missing, basically. That means that the NHS isn't achieving the same kind of successes in chronic disease. What do you think?
I completely concur. I think, if Humpty Dumpty had had his accident in the UK, he'd have probably been fine. I think
Right.
the King's horses were probably a good deal less competent than the experts that we have in the UK. But I don't know if he'd have actually prevented Humpty Dumpty having his accident. I think we're pretty
Right.
good at treating issues when they occur, but less good at prevention. And you're right. I mean, perhaps lifestyle medicine and education of folk in relation to health and well-being is exactly what's next. And that's what's going to produce the step change in terms of cancer outcomes, in terms of chronic diseases outcomes, in terms of life expectancy, and also in terms of increasing gross national happiness in the UK. So I think, I mean, if we can embrace this, then that's the future.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned happiness there, because it's interesting. It's not something we even talk about particularly in this country, but I suppose it's beginning to appear within this debate on mental health. I mean, it's the flip side of mental health problems, well, as actually being happy. As we know, there are other countries who actually value happiness at a national level, but that's certainly not up there in the current campaigning, is it? But it's such an issue, though, isn't it? And it's very interesting the way that the kind of lifestyle approaches we've been discussing are directly tied into your happiness.
Exactly. And I think the other key thing is that we all think this is for our children, but I think as I shared at the Creating Wellness event, I think the great philosopher Kylie Minogue said that you're never
Right.
too late, you've still got time.
Right.
So no matter what stage you are in life, then changing stuff in relation to your lifestyle can have a significant and a huge and a very positive impact.
Well, you're certainly proving to be a massive inspiration, I think. I love what you're doing. The fact you're going around talking about this stuff everywhere, you're actually a living example of somebody who does all this stuff. And you're a regular GP. That's a great combination, a powerful combination for me. And so it's great to see you out there. And it's brilliant to hear you talk about it today on the show. We're going to have to finish now. Thank
Yeah,
you.
no, I appreciate that. Thank
Yeah.
you. Thanks for the invite, and I'm sure our paths will cross soon.
I think so. All right. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Don.
I loved what Andrew said about us all being leaders, a brilliant attitude, and one that's foundational to the kind of grassroots movement that's needed to drive the agendas of choice and patient-centred care that have been on the lips of successive UK governments over decades. Links to resources for this show are on the Yes to Life website. That's yestolife.org.uk. Look under Media Centre and then UK Health Radio. I'd like to give another plug for the Linseed Farm visit on the 10th of June. It's near Horsham in Surrey, and apart from having a fabulous day out, you'll learn a lot from expert Derwin Banks about the health benefits of linseed. Look under events on the Yes to Life website for more information and for booking. Next week, I'm talking to Peter Starr, American documentary maker and tireless campaigner for better treatment for prostate cancer. Goodbye. Thank you.